Shayna, my dear.
Christopher, my love.
Today's show, just to remind you,
yes,
is one in our signature series of climate dialogues. We're going to do some special promotion of this special series. So we think, as we build our show, Shayna, that these climate dialogues will be reaching some new people.
We're hoping to have new listeners, yes. Excellent. So what do you want these new listeners to know, Chris?
What I want you to help me remember, Shayna, is three things to ask these new listeners. One is to follow us on Instagram and Facebook at What in Gods. The second thing I want you to help me remember is to invite people to get on our mailing list so we can stay in touch. And people can do that at our website, whatingods.com.
Yes.
And the third thing that we invite people to do is share our show with your people.
Okay, let me see if I got it. Chris, one, follow us on Instagram and Facebook at What in Gods. Two, sign up for our mailing list. And three, share the show with your friends.
Oh, thank you. You're going to help me remember by having reiterated that. I appreciate
yes,
that.
Yes, now that I've got it clipped into my head.
If you are listening to What in God's Name for the first time, we think we have something special to offer for our shared common life that is unique in approach and unique in execution. People tell us our show is refreshing and needed. As we aim to reframe public conversations from the economic and the political to the theological and the moral, so as to lift up our key phrase, human flourishing.
Amen.
Love it.
So, Chris, let's dive into our third in the environmental series featuring Michelle Fraser and Tom Ackerman.
Welcome to What in God's Name? She is Shayna Appel.
And he's Chris Owen.
We are recasting the narrative of our shared common life using the lenses of theology and philosophy.
Getting ourselves beyond the binaries of economics and politics that takes up so much of the wavelength in the public square, but which does nothing to focus us on human flourishing.
Yeah, we want to lift up human and ecological flourishing, which our usual ways of framing public conversations do not do. Today is a special show. We want to welcome a few people, and I will say more about our special show in a second. But first, a welcome in the room is Brandon Edwards, our amazing associate producer, and Susan Peary, a supporter of What in God's Name on Patreon, who gets special access to today's conversation. As I say, today is a special show in our continuing series of conversations on climate change and the climate crisis. As we continue to explore inter-ideological, interdisciplinary crossovers and connections in climate conversations, really arising, Shayna, out of one of our core values, which is go deeper.
And staying curious, I would add. And now we will turn to our guests to shine some light.
Yes, indeed. So today, science and religion, more pointedly, climate science and Christianity. To help us do this, we have two special guests. Both are practicing climate scientists and practicing Christians. Michelle Fraser, welcome. She is a graduate of Princeton University's program in atmospheric and oceanic sciences. Her work there focused on clouds and their role in climate modeling. She is currently doing paleoclimate research at Penn State in the Department of Geosciences. She is also a professional disc golfer. Michelle, say hello. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Tom Ackerman is an atmospheric scientist who studies the climatic influence of volcanic eruptions and asteroid collisions, the impact of clouds on the Earth's climate, and the science and ethics of geoengineering. He's won awards and received recognition for his lifetime of work and teaching, including NASA's Distinguished Public Service Medal for his work as chief scientist of the Atmospheric Radiation Measurement Program at the Pacific Northwest National Laboratory. Tom, welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Michelle, let me start with you. Just to ground our audience, tell us a little about yourself. What would you like our audience to know about you? And can you describe your sense of calling or any formative experiences to be a scientist who studies climate and climate change?
Well, thank you, Chris. I think the audience should know, if they haven't figured it out yet from our bios, I am an early career scientist, whereas Tom is a senior expert and has been around in the field much longer than me. But it is a pleasure to be on this show with him. I got into climate science a bit in a weird way. I had many interests growing up. I was really into music, science, apologetics, all kinds of things. But as I started to actually have to think, what am I going to do in college? I realized I'm actually really good at science, so I should go there. But I wasn't feeling that passionate about it till I realized there was actually a connection between my love of science, particularly my love of weather. I grew up in the Midwest. My sister and I enjoyed tracking the tornadoes and the severe storms that would come through. We had a group we called Stormheads, and we educated our family about severe weather. It was very fun. But I realized there was actually a connection between that and some of the more theological, philosophical passions I had with origin science. And I could do paleoclimate modeling, so modeling of ancient climates to answer questions about our origins and our history, especially in light of the biblical account. So that's how I got into climate science. I wanted to get a good education in the climate modeling to then go do paleoclimate research. So here I am. Took me 7 years to get my PhD in Princeton in lots of training on climate modeling, but I'm finally now doing actual paleoclimate research in my postdoc at Penn State.
Thanks, Michelle. And Tom, let me turn to you. What would you like our audience to know about you?
I want to thank Michelle for being kind, because I'm actually a late career scientist. I have spent more than 50 years studying, doing research, and teaching about climate, and have enjoyed it immensely. I've had the pleasure of being a research scientist at NASA, teaching at two different universities, and also being the chief scientist for a big Department of Energy program. My wife and I started dating in high school. We have been married for more than 50 years, so she has been a faithful partner along the whole journey. And during all this time, my wife and I and our children have attended and participated in church activities our entire lives. It was interesting to listen to Michelle say what she said about, I prefer to call it vocation, that's my Reformed church speak. And I also did not grow up thinking I was going to be an atmospheric scientist. I was always amazed when I taught undergraduates who knew when they were 4 years old that this is what they wanted to do. I went to Calvin College, now Calvin University, and I found my way into a physics major because, like Michelle, I was good at a lot of things. My father, who was a minister, thought I should be a minister, but I had other opinions about that. And so I went to graduate school in physics and was doing fine in my first year and realized I didn't want to do physics research. And by God's good grace, I went and talked to an atmospheric scientist, and he gave me a small project to work on the effect of supersonic transport airplanes on the ozone layer. About 2 months into that, I knew this is what I wanted to do with my life, and I transferred over. But I didn't figure that out till I was my first year in grad school. So it's never too late for a student to change their mind.
Beautiful. I want to honor both of your knowledge and expertise and studies in climate science. And so I am wondering if you can give us a little nugget of climate science from your studies and work that you think is interesting or not talked about enough, that is also graspable by an educated and interested but non-specialist audience. Tom, you want to go first on that?
Such a huge question and so little time to answer. I'm going to give you what is really a big nugget. I think the thing we often don't appreciate when we talk about climate is that we're talking about the balancing of very large numbers. So we absorb, the planet absorbs a lot of radiation from the sun, but emits a lot of radiation as well as thermal radiation. And our climate is the balance between these two large numbers. And then it turns out that there are a few little knobs that we can adjust, sort of like tuning knobs. And it's those tuning knobs that are critical to determining the actual climate that we have. And so most of the research that I'm doing, that Michelle is doing, that hundreds of others are doing, thousands of others are doing, is trying to figure out what determines those knobs. Why do we have the clouds in the atmosphere that we do? How much difference does it make if we add air pollution to the atmosphere? These are the little knobs that fine-tune these giant numbers. And it's amazing that for the last 10 to 15,000 years, the climate of the Earth has been relatively constant. And now we're finding that there are certain parts of the system that have feedbacks in them that we can nudge that take us to places we don't necessarily want to be.
Thanks for that context. That's helpful to me as an interested but non-specialist person to help me. Especially the way you framed it as these large numbers, like that makes a lot of sense to me. Michelle, how about you?
Well, building off of that, you might have picked up, if you're a savvy listener, in both of our bios, Chris mentioned the word clouds. So both Tom and I have done research on clouds. And he mentioned that, too, as one of the knobs that can get turned. So I'm going to give you just a small nugget about clouds. Clouds are unique because they heat and they cool the Earth at the same time. They heat the Earth by contributing to the greenhouse effect. And the greenhouse effect is a good thing. Without it, we would all freeze to death. But they also cool the Earth by reflecting sunlight back to space. Now, there are certain things about climate change that we understand really well. Like, we understand really well that if you put more CO2 in the atmosphere, it's going to warm the atmosphere. It's very basic chemistry and physics. Where climate change gets more complicated is all the ripple effects of that warming in the atmosphere. So a big focus of the really technical science being done about climate change right now is trying to understand what exactly happens to clouds and the different kinds of regimes of clouds in the Earth. Because if you increase, say, your high wispy cirrus clouds, if you increase those, that actually has a different effect on if you increase your low blankety stratus clouds on the Earth. Because the height of the clouds and the denseness of the clouds affects whether they have a net warming or cooling effect on the Earth. So that's what a lot of my research was on. But just when you look up at clouds and think they're really pretty, you can also realize they are a climate scientist's headache. And trying to represent small-scale phenomena like clouds and climate models is a big area of active research, but it's also a really exciting area of research where you get to learn a lot about climate change and also the amazing complexity of our Earth as God designed it.
I just want to add quickly that I don't think sea clouds as a headache. They have paid the bills for a long time in my life.
Shana, I have to say, I don't think we've ever had cloud talk on What in God's Name before, and I'm really like excited that we've got.
I know I already have a slew of questions, but I know you had a couple more that you wanted to get to, so.
Well, I just wanted to pause and note the cloud talk. I mean, anytime we get Stratus and Cirrus in a What in God's Name episode, I think we're doing well. Let me ask one more question, Shana, because that will get us, I want to get us towards this intersection, conversation, dialogue, what many people see as antithetical, the science and religion. And so to Tom and Michelle, you stand in these two different spheres of human knowing and human experience, science and religion, that many Americans see as incompatible. So I'm curious about your experience because you inhabit both of those worlds. I'm interested in your lived experience. And I'm curious if you can relate a story of interacting with someone, maybe a religious person who was quote unquote anti-science, or maybe a scientist who is, again, quote unquote, anti-religion. And what did that person say to you? And how did you respond? And I'll let you sort out which one of you wants to go first.
I can go first. I'm going to give you first a line and then a little story. And the line comes out of a breakfast that I was at with a group of graduate students where we were talking about the subject of religion and science, and we were talking about the difficulties of that. And one young woman in the group stopped the group cold when she said, "I think it's easier to be a Christian in academia than to be an academic in the church." And I was sort of taken aback by that, and yet I understood exactly what she said. Because as a scientist, I don't feel that my work is questioned on the basis of whether I'm a Christian or not. It's questioned on whether it's good or not. The story is a little funnier. I actually taught at Penn State, where Michelle is now, and I was a member of a Presbyterian church, and I was an elder in the church, which meant I occasionally attended presbytery meetings, which are these meetings of regional churches. So I was at a presbytery meeting, and I sat down at a table for lunch, and another elder walked over and sat down with me. We didn't know each other, so we introduced ourselves, and he asked me what I did, and I told him I was a professor of meteorology at Penn State, and immediately stopped, and he said, "Well, how do you manage to work with all those old earth people?" And I sat there for a minute, and then I said, "It's really not a problem, because I think the earth is old." And then he was dumbfounded that I could actually be a Christian and have a view of an old earth. A bunch of other people came over and sat at our table, and they were all known to him and not to me. And so my lunch actually turned into this discussion of, is the earth old or not old? And I felt like I was giving a tutorial instead of having the ability to eat my lunch. I don't know if I changed anybody's minds, but it was just sort of the double shock for both of us.
Part of what's interesting about that, Tom, is that you had the conversation. People engaged, and you engaged, and that's cool.
I have to say, I am still always brought up a little bit short, stopped in my tracks, as it were, when we go back to Scripture and, you know, folks start taking some of it literally, particularly if we're in the Hebrew Scriptures, because, you know, it's one thing to look at Genesis and take that as a as a literal accounting of how the world was formed, versus a poetic one, or one that was designed to counter the narrative that was in place at the time, and then hit the rest of the Hebrew Scriptures and just like, oh, okay, well, don't worry about keeping a kosher kitchen. Don't worry about, you know, how you're planting your crops. Don't worry about whether or not you're, you know, circumcised. Don't worry about any of that stuff. Just, you know, take the bits that work for you and take them literally.
I think the problem is that this idea of, for instance, there are some others, but let's just stick with the young earth, old earth, has become a litmus test of your level of Christianity. I in fact, had a similar conversation, much shorter, just this past week. That again, it is a measure of whether you are a real Christian or not. Because if you're a real Christian, then you accept literally the young earth creation. And I need to challenge that, but I also realize that I'm not going to change a lot of people's opinion.
And as always, I guess it depends on which Christian circles you're swimming in.
I swim in a lot of them. So some people are happy with old earth and some people are not. And the ones who are not, are not.
Yeah, interesting.
When you have large families, Shani, you get to have, I'm one of seven children. And my wife has a very large extended family. So we have lots of relatives.
Yeah.
Yeah. And again, to me, that family metaphor is perfect, because not everybody's going to have the same perspective. And then isn't the task, he asks rhetorically, to stay connected and keep the conversation going. So Michelle, your shot to get in on this question. Do you have a story of, you know, in your experience of, because you inhabit both of these worlds, the world of Christian faith and the world of climate science, any story you want to relate where one side or the other just called you to question?
Yeah, I mean, Tom bringing up age of the Earth, origins, I mentioned earlier, that was how I even got into this whole climate science business. So I could tell 100 stories, I feel like, at this point of what's going on. But I wanted to touch on a couple things Tom said and then tell my own story. He used the word litmus test for the age of the Earth. And I was literally sitting over here thinking that's the problem with this whole age of the Earth question, is it has become like this litmus test. I know good Christians who believe both sides and have scientific reasons for believing both sides. And I don't take that as a litmus test of their Christianity. A better litmus test, if you have to have one, is how seriously do you take the Bible? Do you view the Bible as a source of truth? And then we can get into the question of how do you actually go about interpreting things like the first few chapters of Genesis. A really excellent book on that point that I would love to recommend to your audience. It's a book called The Fool and the Heretic. And it's produced by a group called the Colossian Forum, which is basically dedicated to having conversations between Christians who disagree on important, on secondary issues, but still issues that they're passionate about. And it turns out to be a conversation between a scientist who was involved in an organization called BioLogos. And if you know BioLogos, they're theistic evolutionists. They believe in an old age. They branded themselves as evolutionary creationists. And then a young earth creationist professor who I actually know personally. And he, it's called The Fool and the Heretic because it tends to be that the young earth creationists look at the old earth creationist or the theistic evolutionist as heretics, and the old earth creationists sometimes look at the younger earthers as being fools and not real scientists. And it's just an incredible conversation about two people who are so passionate about what they believe, but came to view the other people differently. Not this litmus test of, oh, you're old earth, therefore you're a heretic, or you're young earth, and therefore you can't be a real scientist. But to actually have a conversation, still disagree with each other on the age of the earth, but come to view each other as brothers in Christ and brothers in science. And I wish we could have that kind of conversation more. I one time ran into at a Christian worldview conference another member of BioLogos, an old earth creationist who is a geologist, and we had a spirited discussion about the age of the earth and our different thoughts on it. But he would basically begged me as a young person in this field to try to be the person who can talk to both camps. And I know this is a bit of sidetrack from climate change, but it comes into climate change because I also interact with people like Tom said that in my church where they think I've been corruptive because I've been in secular academia. And they don't necessarily come out and question my Christianity, even though I think they're thinking that sometime. But how can I be an accurate voice on something like the climate change debate? So before I can even talk to people often in my church about what I believe about climate change, I have to establish my credentials that, yeah, I'm still a Christian. I haven't been corrupted by 7 years at Princeton. It's a very painful experience sometimes to feel like the academy and Christianity have to be at odds.
You are listening to What in God's Name. Our guests on this climate dialogue are Tom Ackerman and Michelle Fraser. Both are scientists studying climate, and both are practicing Christians. If you like what you are hearing, please consider sharing this show via email or social media and join us in the project of enriching our public conversations. You can join us and be sure not to miss any of our work by signing up for our newsletter at our website, whatingods.com. That's one word, whatingods.com. And now, back to our climate dialogue with Tom and Michelle.
So the one story that came to mind when you initially asked the question is when I went to Princeton, I was definitely skeptical about how well I was going to fit in secular academia. And my concerns were magnified when about 2 weeks in, I was attending a seminar at the geosciences department. It was a seminar by a media psychologist who was talking about communicating climate change, a topic I'm really passionate about, especially since I have a sister who is in the field of media psychology. And it was going great. Everyone was learning lots of things. But in the Q&A section, one of the Princeton professors says, well, isn't the reason that conservatives don't believe in climate change is because when you're religious, that means you can believe whatever you want. It doesn't matter what the evidence says. And that really hurt me at the time because I'm sitting there thinking, I'm religious. First of all, religion doesn't mean you can believe whatever you want, no matter what the evidence says. I actually believe there's strong evidence for my worldview beliefs. But also, religious people can believe in climate change. I don't know. I questioned if I belonged there at all when that question happened. And there's been a few moments like that. More often than not, I have felt like I've belonged. People view me as something interesting, a conservative who grew up in Indiana and yet cares about climate change. And I have an interesting story to tell on that, how I've tried to communicate that to my church and my family, my own journey of going into grad school, hoping climate change wasn't real or wasn't as bad as people said, but coming out to find out, the science, it stinks. It's real and we're going to have to do something about it. And so I've had a lot of very helpful conversations with academia, but sometimes I feel like I don't belong either.
It's so interesting because I oftentimes find people who I consider to be pretty smart or pretty well educated, but who aren't religious, will stake a claim or will say things about religion that they couldn't possibly know, but they'll say them, with assurance, with forcefulness, as if I'm an expert in this field here, so therefore I know what's going on in the church, and I find myself very often having to be an apologist for the church or to kind of try to set some people straight about, what's happening. Oh, I don't go to church because, I find God in nature. Well, God, we never talk about nature in church because I guess we'd have to just overlook the whole book of Psalms, So I think there is a lack of knowing in this that our secular world today, especially because the vast majority of the secular world is now third and fourth generation unchurched, that they don't know anything about the church. They really don't. They have no clue. But they think they know based on, what they've seen on TV. And Chris and I have had many conversations on this. I always find it, very irksome that, every time the mainstream media has a religious question, they seem to go out and find the unlettered religious leader who is speaking something that I think very few religious folks in general, but Christians in particular, would go along with. There's some fringe element. So now we've got all these secular people out there running around the world thinking that the church is made up of all of, people who think like that.
Well, on that note, that's an area that I've been really grateful to the community I did have at Princeton because so many of them wanted to ask me about what I believed and how that influenced. I had one of my policy project advisors, so very senior scientists there, would sit me down and ask me things like, so what do you mean when you say the word evangelical? And then I would explain four tenets of evangelicalism, and then he would ask me detailed questions about all of them. Like, he never realized why it was important to Christians to want to evangelize and how that might be affected some of our policies or whatever. And I just really grateful when people are willing to cross those divides and actually learn about people.
Yeah.
If I might, Shana, I could take what you just said about, the secular world looking at the church and substitute almost everywhere the way the church views academia. And it would fit. There is so many times when, as an academic, and Michelle referred to it too, that you are looked on suspiciously. And that's what the young woman I quoted earlier was talking about when she said it's difficult to be an academic in church because you are met with suspicion just for the fact that you have an education. The other thing which I have found is that particularly in sciences, but in higher education in general, you are taught to be critical. All right. My son used to say to me, Dad, you're a cynic. And I go, no, I'm a realist. But you are taught to be critical. And so when you go to the church and that sort of critical nature comes along and you start asking questions that people aren't necessarily comfortable with and you don't really think about it, it's just what you do, this becomes a problem. All right. Because you are not conforming to the established norms. And to me, the sad part is I grew up in a community that didn't see education that way. But that community has been subsumed now into, for better or worse, what I'll call American evangelicalism. Sorry, Michelle. That sort of respect for education and knowledge has really been decimated.
You know, it's so interesting, Tom, it's so interesting to hear you say that. I was raised Jewish and encountered Unitarian Universalism sort of midlife and got a call to ministry and decided to go to a Christian seminary, in fact, to overcome my Christophobia, my fear of all things Christian, and got to seminary and, you know, probably overshot the mark a little bit and came out, got ordained in the United Church of Christ. So I'm not a lifelong, I'm not a cradle Christian. I do come into this from, I guess, left field a little bit. And I would say that, so, and I have standing in the UUA as well. And in both of my denominations, not only is education embraced, but, you know, like you must be lettered to be a minister in a recognized minister by either of these denominations. And for the vast majority, I mean, I would say the whole of Unitarian Universalism and the vast majority of the United Church of Christ are, you know, hardcore on board with what's happening with climate change and climate justice. And there is no separate to be religious in our contexts is to steward the earth. And I don't think the vast majority of the people who, in either of these congregations have any issue whatsoever with academia. In fact, sometimes I wish they would embrace a little less of it and, you know, get down into the heart realm a little bit more. So just interesting because, you know, these when we talk about religion or even when we talk about Christianity, there's always such a big...
It certainly is a diverse... There certainly is a diverse group.
Yeah.
But I will say that the two denominations or affiliations you just discussed are not what I would consider the mainstream of evangelical Christianity.
Oh, no. Oh, God, no. Either would they.
It's okay for you to say that in my group, but yeah. I will say, well, I can name a dozen other groups where that's
sure.
not.
Yeah, and, absolutely.
And I'm more like Paul. I'm a Pharisee of the Pharisees. All right. My father was a minister. My brother's a minister. My son is a minister. So I, by the grace of God, escaped.
Ducked a bullet, did you?
I have been engaged in, and I said, the community I grew up in was affirming of education, but that has gone by the wayside. And I see that lack. My son is a campus pastor and walks this line all the time with his, you know, students and graduate students about how do I convince them that being intellectual is also okay in being a Christian?
Yeah, like our intellect is also of God. Do you have any sense of why that has happened or what has pulled, and this is a question I throw out to both of you, Tom and Michelle, do you have any sense of why that's happened, of why these certain sects of Christianity have become so critical of academia?
I do, and I'm not sure that this is where the show needs to go, but...
You know, Tom, we really never know where it's going.
There are a couple of books that have recently been published that are well worth reading. One is, I'm terrible with titles, the John Wayne book.
Jesus and John Wayne.
Jesus and John Wayne, thank
you. I just
you.
Read that a couple months ago.
And the other is by Catherine Stewart, and it's called The Power Seekers or something like that. And I found that book to be really useful because she traces the rise of the evangelical movement primarily since World War II. And the fact that it has become aligned with politics more than aligned with the Bible, and that has contributed to a distrust of the elite. How many times have we heard people pick on this word elite? I look at it and go, yeah, I'm kind of glad I'm elite. I'm a climate scientist. And there aren't a lot of us around, you know, but that's seen as a dirty word. So I think you have to look at the conjunction of politics and the church.
Well, your question about like why does so much of the church have an aversion to academia, it's actually very similar to, I think, the question of why is so much of the church skeptical of climate change? And it's sort of this, like, so in climate change, we talk about solution aversion. So that's this psychological phenomenon that we all know, that if you're averse to the solution that comes along with a problem, you are less likely to admit there's a problem, right? So if your doctor tells you something's wrong with you and the solution is to just take a pill every day and you'll be fine, you might accept his diagnosis. But if she says that you're going to have to completely change your lifestyle, cut out all these foods, exercise 3 hours a day, you're going to go get a second opinion or maybe just reject the diagnosis altogether. I mean, the same thing is true about climate change. If you're being told that the solution to climate change is something that you're averse to, and I think we're all naturally averse to things that significantly change our way of life, you're less likely to accept it. Where I think there is a parallel with why so much of the church is averse to academia is they think that you send your kid off to academia, they're going to get corrupted and come home a communist Democrat or something like that. And again, it comes back to this weird political divide, but that's the fears that I hear. They think that all professors are out to turn your kid into a communist and a heathen. And I know that's a bit exaggerated, but I hear that enough. But, you know, again, there's these divides that we keep talking about, but they don't necessarily have to be there. I was raised to think critically about everything and ask questions about everything and not to shy away from learning about the people who argue against my belief, because that's only going to make my belief stronger, or maybe I'll be convinced otherwise, but either way, I'll be in the search for truth. But I wanted to go back to something that was said, Tom and I kind of both talk about sometimes not feeling at home in the church as an academic. But there's also ways in which I feel most at home in the church as an academic, and that is because I study natural phenomena in an incredibly designed world that I want to look at it in praise and glory in a creator, whatever version of creation you're believing in, whether that's, you know, a theistic guided evolution or the very conservative young earth creationism, we point to God as the first cause of this incredible world that we live in. And that's what I want to worship and glory in. And I find that in the church. And I get sad when I'm on a campus where most of my peers are rejecting that. And I can't imagine being a scientist and not thinking I'm doing this because I'm, as Johannes Kepler is famous for quoting, thinking God's thoughts after him, learning about a God who made this incredible world, and then learning how to best use this world to promote human flourishing. But, you know, I told you I study clouds. I have a wood banner in my house that with my favorite verse on it, Zechariah 10:1, it is the Lord who makes the storm clouds. That is what I often think of when I'm doing clouds. I love Job 37 that talks about how God loads the clouds with moisture and sends them to swirl across the face of the earth. I study clouds and circulation and humidity, and I love that that is right there in scripture. Obviously, that's poetic. I'm not like learning science from Job 37, but I'm learning who is behind the science that I'm studying. So I do feel at home in the church, even though, so there shouldn't be a divide, I guess is what I'm saying. Christians should want to learn more about clouds and climate change because it affects people, and we care about people because, well, at least we should, because God cares about people and we should be caring about what God cares about. That was my attempt to bring this conversation back to climate change.
And you did well. Shana, did you want to jump in? Because I do have some
just,
jump in.
Just really quick to say, you know, Michelle, as you were talking, I was thinking, you know, it's so interesting how sometimes as an academic, you feel at odds with people in your church, you know, whereas I'm in the so-called liberal church, right? You know, the church of the big thinking head. And I oftentimes feel a little out of place being like the God person. You know, in my church, the fact that I am really rooted in that mystery. And that can be a different place to dwell in. You know, if you're a mystic in an intellectual church, you're going to be a little bit at crosshairs, or you're going to be sort of the odd guy out. So it's just kind of interesting that here we have all these wonderful churches and we're all trying to be part of them. And, you know, yeah.
Michelle, I wanted to thank you for your words and your witness. And so first of all, that. And then secondly, I wanted to, since I'm more or less driving the conversation, I'm going to take the final word and pivot us onto the next. And my final word is a little both-sides-ism I'm going to inject. We spent a little bit of time talking about Jesus and John Wayne, the collapse of the theological to the political in certain branches of Christianity. That happens in the branches of Christianity that Shana and I are connected with too, this collapse of the theological or the religious into the political. So here's my plug. You know, part of what in God's name is intending to do is not to take sides in that left versus right political thing, but to re-carve out, reclaim this theological space as the ground and the beginning of better conversations. So that's my both sidesism. Let me pivot because I want to get to Tom's question about the existential threat. But before we do that, and I am looking at the time, I wanted to create a space for Susan and Brandon if you wanted to get in at this point with a question for Tom and Michelle.
My thought as I was listening to this conversation, which is so interesting, is
this is Susan Peary, who received an invitation from us to join the call, and thanks for her support on Patreon.com.
There's a huge strain of like anti-intellectualism in American culture and history, and that really plays into it too. And there are so many different denominations that kind of identify it in one place or another along that kind of scale. And it's, I think people have a tendency to think you have to pick one camp or another, and they make assumptions about what other people think that are black and white differences from where they are. But it's really more of, it's sort of a spectrum, but there really is a tradition of anti-intellectualism that science has to fight against.
Yeah, I think that's true in American society for sure. We don't have the know-nothings for no reason. But my sense is that this has gotten worse recently, because I'm old, you know, 20, 30 years, than it was before. Maybe I was just naive when I was growing up. I mean, I grew up in small town community, and I didn't feel then that, you know, learning things and going to, of course, it was also my parents who thought all of their kids needed to go to college, that maybe I was just naive. But I think this sense of, and I didn't hear it in the church, that you shouldn't go to school, that, you know, going off to college was somehow or other going to pollute your mind. But I hear that much more now than I remember when I was growing up. And so I think this division has grown on us, whether and maybe it's not grown in society as much as we see it manifest in the church.
Well, it feels like everything in our culture now has to be seen in binaries. I mean, the obvious binary is the political one, right? I can't be a fiscal conservative or a social policy conservative and care about climate change and maybe be okay with allowing some more immigration or something like that. Like, I can't be those two things. Those, I'm not supposed to exist. And we now have come to see a divide between, yeah, church and intellectualism for some reason, when there absolutely needs be absolutely zero divide between the two of them. And I guess in having discovered your show since being invited on it, I'm really excited to hear your passion for trying to move beyond that binary. And let's bring the whole person to these discussions. When we discuss solution to climate change, let's not just go back to our party platform, but bring our philosophy, our theology, our training, if we know something about clouds or whatever, to bear on the topic.
Actual knowledge, yes.
Nice. Brandon, did you have anything? I wanted to give you a chance if you do. Brandon Edwards, if you don't know, is our associate producer on What in God's Name.
Yeah, I just wanted to dive in and mostly just express gratitude, because this conversation, as it often does, was serendipitous in that it went toward religion and education, which is what I spend my time and my scholarly pursuits looking at. And, you know, a lot of what both Michelle and Tom have said has resonated with me as a scholar who goes into churches to investigate what is really at stake in this binary. And one of the things that resonated with me, which I just want to add, is that it probably won't surprise you that as a Christian who goes into these churches from Harvard, the first question I usually get is from these people, are you a Christian? And so that is the first question I get. And if I feel that if I don't answer it in quite the right way, I probably will not be able to be admitted there. And that is a very interesting sort of anecdote in and of itself. And so, you know, to echo what Michelle has just said, I think that's why I want to be a part of this show and this project, because for me, I think one of the things that's alarming is that in my research, I have worried that evangelicals, which I grew up as, have this decision point to make when they're going to college about whether they stay in the sectarian sort of version of post-secondary education or they go to the secular version. And the reality is, because of the sphere of education, as we see it right now around critical race theory and other things, this is not a decision point when going to college. This is actually a decision point for parents much sooner. That's not at all related to climate science or climate change, but it's something that I felt like was on my heart to share, so I did so. So thank you for inviting me into it.
Hey, Chris, there was one question on your list to ask, and I sort of feel like Brandon has steered us toward that, and I wonder if you'd be okay if we popped it out there and just...
I'm happy to go there. I also want to go to Tom's question. So really, I would love to do both. It's really a question, Tom and Michelle, can we go past an hour? Can you go a little bit longer and take both of those questions?
I can go past an hour, and I can also work on keeping my answers more succinct. So.
No, your answers have been great.
Tom, how about you? Do you have a little time to go past an hour?
I absolutely do, and I won't keep my answers succinct because it's not possible.
I like your honesty.
You are listening to What in God's Name. Our guests on this climate dialogue are Tom Ackerman and Michelle Fraser. Both are scientists studying climate, and both are practicing Christians. If you like what you are hearing, please consider sharing this show via email or social media and join us in the project of enriching our public conversations. You can join us and be sure not to miss any of our work by signing up for our newsletter at our website, whatingods.com. That's one word, whatingods.com. And now, back to our climate dialogue with Tom and Michelle.
Back to the climate crisis. What are the limits and what is missing if we address the climate crisis only with science and technology without any spiritual or moral awakening? Conversely, what are the limits and what is missing if we address the climate crisis only by somehow achieving a societal spiritual awakening without science and technology?
If I could take a stab at that, no offense, but I don't like the way that question is phrased. And the reason I don't like it is because if there is no science, there is no climate crisis. All right? It's the science that tells you there's a climate problem. If there's no science, nobody knows. So you don't have a climate crisis without science. It's also science that suggests things that can be done in order to mitigate the effects. So that's the first thing. On the other side, science does not tell you what to do in terms of solutions. Society has to take those actions. And society has to arrive at those actions through some sort of moral awakening is the right term, but maybe it is. I don't know another one, so I'll just use moral awakening. And then I will add, you know, Shana, I find the sad part here is that the religious community is not leading the moral awakening. I have so many of my colleagues, my non-church attending, and I won't say non-religious, maybe I should, colleagues, who are really actively trying to make this moral awakening happen, and the church is dragging its feet.
Right. I mean, that's the reason I ever got passionate about trying to communicate climate change to my religious audiences, because I think religion has something to bring on the climate crisis, because there's ultimately going to be trade-offs anytime you try to solve a problem. And you got to have a moral, ethical sense to decide which way to go on the trade-offs. So science can tell you climate change is a problem. It's going to maybe have these specific effects, these chances of them. We should do some. Therefore, the obvious implication is we should do something about it. But it gets very frustrating for me, again, in that political divide. And I bring up the political divide because often religious people, depending on your church, whatever church your denomination you're in, that's what I was looking for, is going to go on one side of that political divide, obviously. So they're either completely into this climate conversation or they're completely out of it. And I'd like to see both of them in it. So when I try to communicate to my conservative Christian audience, I first like, just forget about politics. Let's talk about the problem. Okay, now we can talk about how our religious background. So our religious background might suggest that we promote human flourishing over a more nebulous goal of just saving the ecosystem. Not that we don't care about the ecosystem. The ecosystem was designed by God and humans were made to steward it. But it might put a slightly different note on it. So yeah, you absolutely have to have the religious side in addition to the science side. But Tom is right. There is no crisis without having the science to know what's going on in the first place.
So from an anti-academic religious perspective, I mean, we're seeing things, but we would ascribe them differently. We're seeing that storms are getting more severe. We're seeing water rising, but maybe we just ascribe that to the coming of the end of times or...
I think what happens in that case is you simply ascribe it to the vagaries of climate. All right. It's just, you know, we're in that phase. So, you know, you can ask, why are Michelle and I so convinced that climate change is happening? We're only convinced that climate change is happening because we have people doing paleoclimate research that have looked at the history of climate, particularly over the last, 15 to 20,000 years, have looked at climate, but even longer than that, over the last million years and the ice age cycles. We also know that because we have models that people have built and have run and asked, you know, what happens when I change the carbon dioxide concentration? And then we look at the data over the last 100 years. So all of this has convinced us that we know what we're talking about, that this is not, I mean, I can go back and say, yeah, there's some guy back in, you know, 1850 who talked about CO2 controlling climate. All right. And there was, but that's not what convinces us that climate change is happening. So we need that grounding. And then I totally agree with Michelle. We have to convince people that this is happening before we can get them to buy in. I have taught a class twice with a philosophy professor on science and ethics. And it was fascinating to me, particularly when we talked about climate engineering, that my philosophy colleague is not a Christian. And so the question then of why, how do you establish what is good in the sense of what I should do about things, becomes a very different proposition for the two of us, because we start from somewhere different.
While we start from somewhere different, there's also more in common, I think, sometimes than we realize. So there was a really interesting study back from a couple years ago by the Yale Center for Climate Change Research that split the respondents to the study into Christians and non-Christians and asked their motivations for wanting to mitigate global warming. So people who cared about climate change, what is their motivation for wanting to do something about it? And in the top two, for both sides, Christians and non-Christians, there was the commonality of provide a better life for our children and grandchildren. For the non-Christians, the top one was actually prevent destruction of most life on the planet. And for the Christians, the second one up there was protect God's creation. Now, there was some overlap in them. But first of all, we have this commonality of caring for our children and grandchildren. But then we're just going to word the other things sort of differently, whether it's protecting most life on the planet or protecting God's creation. It's a subtle difference, but it could actually practically look very similar. So there's also a role in just using the right language to talk to different audiences about it, and which is where I want to go push back the tiniest bit on something Tom just said when he's talking about how we as scientists know that climate change is real. Yes, we look at the paleoclimate record, but we don't have to look at million-year-old ice cores to convince someone that climate change is real. In fact, if you do that, you're going to lose the entire young Earth creationist audience. There is absolutely no need to show that figure to establish that climate change is real. And I'm just putting that out there. If you're trying to communicate to a conservative audience, that much isn't necessary. Now, I know that can be hard as a scientist if you believe in the old Earth paradigm and you think there's that fundamental science. I spoke to a geoscientist at a conference once, and we were together lamenting over the difficulties in trying to talk to conservative friends about climate change. And she admitted that one of the problems was she works with deep time. So she's interpreting the layers of rocks that we see around the world as being millions of years old. Young Earth creationists use the same terms for those layers. They just think it's a lot shorter time period. And she wanted to use that to explain climate change. But she said she was being pushed back on her family because they're young earthers. And I'm like, well, why don't you just explain climate change without that? And she's like, but that's who I am. Like, that is my science. I both sympathize with her in wanting to be known and respected for who she is. But I actually think that has to be a separate question. Now, it's a little different when you're caring about your family and the people you're close-knit to. But if you're trying to reach a wider audience, maybe leave that at the door and use the pieces of evidence that's going to convince your specific audience instead of trying to bring every single evidence to bear on the subject. Just a thought from my experience.
They just want the answer. They don't want the lectures. <It's> another version of...
I totally agree with Michelle. And I wasn't suggesting that what I was saying was how we communicate.
Oh, I know that. I've seen it.
I am a big advocate, just like Michelle is, for trying to make sure that you understand the audience you're talking to. We have a speakers organization that gets speakers through our climate change program here at the University of Washington, and I'm on that list. And the woman who runs the list knows that if there's a request that comes in from a religious group, I am most likely the one who will answer. And I tell her, I will go do that because I understand the language. And I think that's what Michelle's saying, and she and I would be in total agreement on that. You got to know your audience.
And it's not just knowing the right language. Like, you can't just kind of take a class on what the other side believes and think now they're going to respect you. You also have to have something in common. You know, the fact that you both agree that Jesus is the savior of the world establishes a commonality. I mean, I think about where I grew up in rural Indiana. The main message, you know, I was getting without studying climate change in depth that our family gets about who says climate change is real, it's Al Gore. And we might disagree with his politics, so why would we listen to him, right? Because we maybe feel like, and again, I'm kind of succumbing to that binary, saying we'd have nothing in common with him. Not necessarily true. But that's easy enough to feel, especially if you're averse to the solution of climate change. So having someone who not only knows the right language, but also has something in common is really what's been shown to be very helpful in climate change communication. Of course, the biggest champion of that, you probably are all familiar with Catherine Hayhoe. She's a professor out of Texas who's done lots of TED Talks on this subject. And she'll tell you the most important thing we can do about climate change is to talk about it, starting from some commonality that we have with the person we're talking to.
Let me steer us towards the last question of our conversation today. And just to clarify for our listeners, this question came from Tom as we were preparing to have this conversation today. And I think it's a great question that gets, again, it's a different approach into this dialogue of science and religion and how we negotiate what, in the popular mind, is antagonistic. So the question is this: we often hear climate change described as an existential threat to human existence, an existential threat to human existence. How do you, as a Christian and a climate scientist, view this description? Is it accurate? Tom, since you raised the question, let's start with you.
So I will revert to my philosophy training here and say that the important thing is to define what you mean by existential. And if you think that existential means that the survival of the human race is in question, then I will push back on that from both the point of view of a scientist and a Christian. the human race is not going away over climate change. In my more facetious moments, I tell my students that there are two survivor races, humans and cockroaches. Now, that, however, is taking the sort of far end view. If you say that existential in this case relates to things that may go out of existence because of climate change, then there are certainly human cultures that we can think about. There are certainly other species. There may even be some branches, if you want to call them that, of human life that go extinct because of what we are doing. A simplest example of human culture is the culture of the Pacific Islanders. Those people are going to be looking for homes because their homes are going to go underwater. So what do we do about that? And do we simply allow them to go extinct? The second thing we can think about existential is saying that it relates here in this context to the big questions of life. All right. That existential doesn't mean whether your existence, but what are the things that determine whether your existence is meaningful? And I think this is really interesting. This is where I think this question becomes really interesting, because if we as a society cannot deal with the question of climate change as it threatens our planet, then we probably can't deal with other threats either. And then our world is going to degenerate into nationalism, sectarianism, a whole bunch of little inevitable conflicts, and maybe giant war. So I think existential here needs to be defined. And if you define it carefully, then climate change may in fact be an existential threat to what we view as what we think human society and human life on this planet should look like.
So I agree with everything Tom just said. Just want to add a couple thoughts to it. Going back to this big picture question of the existential threat, like could it wipe out of all of the human race? Again, no, but I want to elaborate that on a little, because a passage that I hear quoted by Christians a lot in saying we don't have to worry about climate change is God's promise to Noah after God, you know, destroys the earth in a flood, leaving Noah and his family and the animals on the ark. He promises Noah in Genesis chapter 8 that never again will I destroy all living creatures, but as long as the earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night will never cease. And some people use that to say there can't be any climate change. I would say that means God's not going to let an asteroid hit the earth and destroy all of earth before he returns. God is not going to allow us to somehow end up in a Venus-like runaway greenhouse climate state where life would be impossible. That doesn't mean God is not going to allow there to be legitimate consequences for our actions as human beings here on a fallen and sinful world. And, you know, you mentioned at the beginning of the show when you introduced it, the term human flourishing. That is, along with my deep curiosity about origin science, why I got into science is human flourishing. Now, like Tom, I did my undergrad in physics. I did it specifically knowing I wanted it to set me up for an atmospheric science PhD. But of course, along the way, I was tempted to go off, do my physics PhD, study string theory or modern physics. At least some people tried to get me to go there. I was never legitimately tempted by it. Not because those things aren't worthwhile to pursue, but it was hard for me to see the direct impact on human flourishing. I'm not criticizing string theorists or modern physics. There are actually practical applications, I believe, in some of that. But I wanted to work in a discipline where I directly saw the human impact. And that's why I love climate science, because it is an existential threat if you're defining it in the way that it does affect all of humanity. And I care about that, and I want to know the science, to know what's happening to humanity, but then I also want to bring my religion and my philosophical opinions into the question of what to do about that. So I do think we need to help Christians understand that there isn't some reason to a priori for the scripture say climate change is impossible. Then once we remove that, let's look at the science, as we talked about earlier, to demonstrate there is climate change. And then, since we as humans should care deeply about human flourishing, then let's be the lead on the voice on this, continuing this conversation about climate change and what to do about it.
That's a great place to bring this plane into the runway and the landing strip. So thank you for those words, Michelle. And I will just pause before we do our show closing. Is there anything else anyone would like to add at this point?
I just want to say to Michelle that I find it fascinating that we ended up where we are both thinking so much alike. I want to understand why we have the world we have and what are we doing for better or worse. And I said, yeah, this is why I learned all that physics stuff. She's just smarter than me because she got there a lot faster. I had to go to graduate school before I figured it out.
I thought I had my whole life planned out by the time I applied to college. I'm like getting my undergrad physics, so do my PhD in atmospheric science and then go do creation science research. And some of that has stayed the same. The big thing is I've now become passionate about climate change and how it affects humans along the way. And I can keep doing that while also digging into origins question. And I'm glad God brought me that way. I did not see that coming, definitely.
Well, I'm just grateful that people like you are, you know, out there getting beyond the binary and, you know, looking at these problems both in terms of the science and in terms of, you know, how we can communicate and change the tide of this fallen and sinful planet, you know, in the hopes of saving it and in the hopes of leaving something better for our children and grandchildren. So I want to thank the two of you for joining us today. And also, great as always, Brandon, to have you with us. And Susan, great to have you with us today as well.
Be curious, Shana.
Go deep, Chris.
And shine light. Our show today is brought to you by our generous donors on Patreon. You can join our generous donors on Patreon by going to Patreon. We would love that, and we would also love it if you go on to Apple Podcasts and give us a review or sign up to receive our podcast from our website, whatingods.com, which is, Shana, as we try to do this on Zoom,
WHATINGODS.
Great to be with you and all of our guests today.
Indeed, indeed. Take care.
That was just so awesome. I am so grateful to you, Michelle, and to you, Tom, to spend this time. What a gift.
I am very grateful for this conversation myself. Thank you.
What a gift.
So much.